Want to expand the influence of design? Pragmatic Institute offers interactive, actionable courses for designers who are looking to contribute more strategically in their organizations. Explore our offerings such as Business Strategy and Design and Influence Through Storytelling at pragmaticinstitute.com/design.
And welcome to Design Chats, a podcast from Pragmatic Institute, where we sit down with design leaders, practitioners, and alumni to discuss how to grow the strategic impact of design. I'm Erin Thibault, Marketing Manager for Pragmatic Institute's Design Practice, and guest host for today's episode. I'm excited to introduce Alexandra Melnikova. Alexandra is an experienced designer, strategist, and co-founder of Cosmic Velocity, an inclusive research, UX, and service design agency based in London. Welcome to Design Chats, Alex.
Awesome. Thank you, Erin. Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, we're so happy to have you on. So at Design Chats, we're always really interested in people's stories, and I know that yours is particularly fascinating. I would love to just kick us off with you sharing a little bit about your journey, what first sparked your interest in design, and where has it led you so far?
Oh, gosh. Okay. We'll start from the very, very long time ago. So I was born in Lithuania, in Vilnius, still in the times of USSR, and then Union luckily collapsed when I was 6 years old, and Lithuania started their beautiful journey into independence. So I studied pretty much everything and anything, to be honest. My first degree was officially in graphic design, but arts were a huge part of it. So I did painting, sculpture, drawing. I did philosophy, psychology, comparative theory of civilizations, like so many subjects. And I loved it, to be honest. Really early on, I understood that I didn't want to perhaps make another thing. But I had that question always, why should you make things? How things are useful? How do they fit into a wider picture than perhaps a designer is focusing on? So that was the questions that kind of troubled me from early on. In my second year of uni, I did an exchange year in Italy, in Milan. Fell in love with the university, did a lot of, again, random courses on cinema, cinematography, history of photography, things like that. So everything in and around art, culture, and history. And then got back there for my master's to study product service systems design, which was one of the first service design courses offered, I think, in Europe at least. So I keep constantly hearing that people studied service design, and chances are very likely that we're from the same course. For a second year, I can tell you there was 50 of us from a variety of countries, and we learned so much from each other. It was a very experimental course at that point because the foundations of service design were just about being established. If anything, you know, UX wasn't even a thing back then. I started in 2007, finished in 2009. So those 2 years. So, wow, 10 years ago. No, more than 10. What am I saying? I'm counting pre-COVID years. Can someone count 2 years of our lives? Yeah, Jesus. No, much more than that, like 14 years, 13 years. Yeah, so that was that. And then after, a lot of subjects were available in terms of like who could I have been. I could have been a strategist. I could have stayed a designer. So I started as a sort of brand web designer. I used to even flirt with code in the beginning. So I did... end-to-end design from the brand to kind of the end product and digital product. And I decided to move to London with like never having been to London. I've traveled through Europe. Somehow London escaped it with places 13 years ago, and a lot of desire to like change things. And it was very difficult in the beginning because my first job was very much in that kind of web design / visual space. And then I started moving into UX and started leading teams pretty early, which then enabled me to really understand research and kind of UX part of research, because I did research as a part of my academic degree, but that's very different. And, you know, ethnography in the field is very different from ethnography in the books.
Yeah.
That's what I discovered. So I think that was the journey. And then, yeah, I led a lot of UX and research teams. And then about a half a year ago, just started kind of thinking about starting my own thing and thinking about how might it be different from everyone else out there. So, yeah.
So it sounds like there were these threads of UX research and experience design and service design. What did you, as you kind of grew in your career and started leading more teams, how did you want to harness those themes in designing what came next?
I always thought that UX is a field, if we look at the history of UX, first of all, and in general, you know, how it all started, information architects, people drawing diagrams, kind of understanding the structure of things, then people separately designing the interface. So we had someone called interface designers, you remember, or interaction designers even. So for me, I guess what I always wanted to do, I never wanted to fixate on the discipline, because UX, in my view, it's kind of a transient discipline, it's going to pass. It's already more to something more meaningful within service design space, within product. So kind of gaining a bit more and much more business focused, intrinsic understanding of the system that is operating within. So it's becoming less surface level, deeper, and kind of much deeper as a field, as a discipline, as it's morphing. And that's what I was always very keen to do. Like, to be transparent with you, for instance, I was never really interested in industry conferences or going to those or listening to things that are happening there, because they are the same field and this field is young. Whilst if you look at, like, I don't know, two oldest sciences in the world, maths and philosophy together, there is much more in that space that is interesting that we can then apply to same subject matter to get different results. So I'm not like an adept of, I don't know, Double Diamond or Safe Agile or something like this. I always like challenging structures and frameworks. And that's something that I'm very keen to, you know, take with me wherever I go, whatever
challenge. And it sounds like you come from a very multidisciplinary background, and your work and your perspective like lives at the intersection of a lot of different things, of art, yeah, of history, of philosophy, UX, service, research,
yes,
inclusive design.
I still don't know who I want to be when I grow up. And will I ever grow up? I'm not sure.
That's the perennial question. I was curious. So you have now launched a new inclusive research, UX, and service design agency, Cosmic Velocity. I'd love to hear what prompted you and your co-founders to start your own thing.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, it was a point in time in which all of us were considering or already en route to leave the previous place and freelance. So that's kind of one. And then we started talking and we realized that in between us, we share this very, very important view on design, which is fundamental in terms of like how design can change people's lives for better, what kind of clients we would love to work with, what kind of challenges would we like to look at, how might we in general, you know, the world before us and the world after us, like, does it differ? And we felt like fundamentally we really agreed on those things, on like how we could use design as a skill set to help people, to make the world more inclusive in essence. And that's something that kind of pulled us together, and we realized that it's much, much better to try and kind of make it a targeted effort rather than do another thing or be another freelancer. I think it was just about time for us and accumulated knowledge. So we all worked in agencies before, we all worked in different environments before. And, you know, like when you run experiments and you run them and you run them and then you learn, and then you are at the point where you are ready to use the learnings. I think that point, we just recognize that point in each other, like it happened simultaneously. Yeah. We're like, okay, so how might we use the learnings that we had to date to build something fundamentally different from what we've seen?
Yeah, so it sounds like there's a little bit of, you're looking at the consultative landscape and you're noticing something that's missing or something you want to do differently, but there's also this aspirational vision of what your agency can do.
Definitely. There are definitely those two things. Like, for instance, there were many things that I've seen through the life at the agency as a head of department, as a huge part of the new business team. Like, I ran so many pitches and I couldn't help but notice how agencies pitch against each other instead of partnering. And it always troubled me as a non-resourceful way of doing things in terms of almost design waste. Like, you kind of come up with huge concepts or things and they never happen. And you use all that effort and energy to prove that you're better than other four agencies instead of like partnering for aspects of the project. So like pitching was a huge bugbear in terms of, I love working with people and solving problems with businesses, but it felt like such an inefficient waste of time, if I'm transparent with the that's kind of one that I was like, I would love to. So in the current setup, we partner with startups, we partner with design agencies to help on different engagements and so on. And our motto in general is that we don't compete. We're a non-competing agency. We partner, we help people, and we try and find partners whose values align to our values. And that's the important part.
Yeah. So talk about those values. What are those values that you are trying to put into practice at your agency to work towards that vision of making the world more inclusive?
Yeah. So that's actually a very, very good point in terms of what they are. So as designers, we kind of went through this whole area of like brainstorming of what they are. And do you know the values exercise? Are you familiar with any values exercises, personal values of like?
I have heard of a few of them, yes, but I'm not sure what the more formal design values exercises look like.
The way I like to think about values is not something that you kind of put on the wall and you're like happy about. It's something that you can't live without, or something that if someone crosses that boundary for you, you feel really, really upset. You feel not like yourself. You're like, that's fundamental. So for me, those are fundamental things within kind of how you operate, how you act, how you behave. And we've done individual exercises on values for ourselves. And then we saw the areas where we cross and the areas where we differ, the areas that kind of coincide. And then from the other perspective, we looked at the business that we would like to build and, you know, the kind of values that we would like to have as a partner to other agencies, other businesses. And essentially this is how our values were born. So that's a bit of a pretext on like how that happened. Our first values, honesty. So we're very much like we saw in our experience, companies work with different companies in different ways. And we wanted to be honest. And being honest means sometimes very difficult conversations, which to be honest, three of us being from like culturally diverse backgrounds. So I'm Lithuanian, my other co-founder is Ukrainian, the third co-founder is British. So three of us kind of cover that aspect. We can in different areas of,
That's interesting.
Yeah, we felt like we can definitely be like quite straightforward talking, straightforward thinking, and we've learned that through our career. So that's kind of one. Second one is inclusion. So we foster inclusion and like every step of the way. When I say inclusion, it's an interesting thing. I had that conversation today with one of the event attendees. We talked about diversity and inclusion as a flag that the company waves and says we're inclusive and includes the voices, but are the voices heard? And that's, for us, it's essential that whoever we work with and in whatever way we work, we just foster that inclusion at every step. And when I say inclusion, accessibility is a tiny part of it. So accessibility, making the services accessible, so reducing barriers to entry, whilst inclusion has so many more assets to it, has so many more dimensions. So like, think about it as how everyone, absolutely everyone on the planet might be different in different ways. That's a lot of things to think about and a lot of things to classify. So a lot of people argue about different dimensions of diversity and inclusion. But
with accessibility as the floor, not the ceiling when you're having the inclusion conversation.
Definitely not the ceiling. To give you a very simple example. So, you know, gender-related questions are not getting raised during accessibility reviews. Not necessarily, but it is a part of inclusion, right? The language that you use should be inclusive to different people, but it currently is not necessarily a part of the accessibility audit if someone were to make an accessibility audit, right? So that's why I really like looking at things quite wide in terms of inclusion, but also quite specific within that. So we created a game recently we ran with HMRC for making your research more inclusive. And there we have, if I'm not mistaken, 25 different cards for potential inclusion. And they range from hidden impairments, from vision and hearing impairments, to mobility, to movement, to vulnerability, to financial hardship, to... So there is such a huge moving scale around. And the most difficult thing, as a lot of people will tell you who work within that space, is that sometimes multiple things happen or are a part of someone's life experience at any given point. So it's not like you look at the customer and you're like, okay, they have this mobility need that we need to account for. It's also very often a multitude of things on that.
It's intersectional, you could say.
Yeah. Yes, it's intersectional, exactly. Sorry, that was a very long way to say second value is inclusion. But yes, and we still work like the beauty of that field. I can't stop talking about it because I am fascinated by how beautiful and ever changing it is. And I can never put my finger on it and say I've learned stuff. I've learned frameworks. I've learned how to approach it in different ways. And I keep learning. So that's the kind of, and I guess that brings us to the next value, which is nerdiness. So
I love that that's a value.
Yes. Because like we had to be honest with ourselves. Like we absolutely, sometimes we would have these partner calls, like founder calls, and we have a lot of things to solve, new business to run and so on. But then we would spend like some ridiculous amount of time discussing some new theory or new framework within a certain area or a new way of looking at things, or like arguing over the past and like art and culture and whatever. And then we have to stop ourselves at some point and go, okay, now, no, seriously. We need to talk about like, because we do disagree over like some areas of art, culture, philosophy stuff, but that is just interesting. Like, I think we like spending time with each other as three practitioners as well. So that kind of helps. But yeah, nerdiness is like, we live to learn. And every time we get an opportunity to learn, recently we were talking to a client within sustainability space, and we were like in this absolute happiness in the sense like, I can't believe I'm going to potentially get paid to research into sustainability.
Yeah.
Like that's the ultimate dream to kind of try and hit for us, I think. And which brings me to the next value. I'm like, I'm very small thing. So sustainability is one of our key values as well. In the beginning of the setting up the agency, we talked about circularity a lot and like how we make our processes efficient, how we help our clients to understand sustainability. So, you know, like people talk about it, and the moment they mention the word, everybody's like, oh, it's everything. It's so many things. It actually has quite a specific definition from like 1987. There is this Brundtland definition of sustainability, which is basically about serving the needs of the present without compromising the needs of the future. And that's just like, you know, it's very boxed. And then you can apply it to, of course, there are sustainable development goals. There is.
That's a very elegant definition. I like that.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And I thought, you know, it applied to many, many areas. We can really look at what we're doing now and be more accountable and more responsible for what we're creating, both as designers, but also in partnership with companies. You asked a question in the beginning around how what I would like to kind of carry through my work. And one of those things is definitely that accountability for what you're doing, but you can only have that accountability when you're very close to the strategic source, which is a business model. So that's why partnerships are very, very key in that, and kind of understanding how the business truly works.
Yeah, so that kind of brings me to the question, what
Yeah.
What do the ideal partnerships and projects look like? Because you're not only trying to apply these values in the work you're doing, but you want to almost use them, it sounds like, as a filtering mechanism for the people you're partnering with, the focus areas for your projects. So what could some of those projects or clients look like?
Yeah. So I think for us, so in terms of the type of businesses we work with, we work with startups, we work with design agencies and kind of brand agencies, and we work with different kind of size businesses, to be honest. Like the third category is quite wide. I think subject matter is important, but what is more important for us is that desire that I mentioned, desire to change things for the better for people. Mm-hmm. And desire to work in a very open manner. I remember, who was it? It was one of the Pentagram founders that I listened to ages ago. And he said, you know, what's the difference between successful and not successful project is the client that trusted me. And the trust is not implicit. It's not about, you know, just like blindly trusting each other's decisions. I guess it is about very much working together. And by together, I mean being transparent, both about like the financial side of it, the kind of flow of the project, the deliverables, the outcomes. So for me, that relationship that I've sometimes seen through the agencies of like supplier and buyer, it's not our story. For us, it is partnership. And I keep using that word. Like, we are talking to clients at the moment, like applying for grants together within like education, health tech. We're helping them, but we're also being a part of this process and learning, and then together building products that can change people's lives for better. So for us, it's about that, yeah, relationship, I guess, in every sense of the word. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. It's about transparency and openness. And it requires having knowledge of the business model of your partners, which I think goes hand in hand with that transparency. I did want to go back to, you know, you've talked about how passionate you are about diversity and inclusion, and you've been involved in that work for a while. How have you seen the landscape of diversity inclusion in design specifically evolve? And what does that, maybe what does the future look like in the direction you've seen it go?
Yeah. When you say in design, do you mean in all of the companies or in design agencies? Because there is definitely a difference in that.
Well, you can speak from a consultancy perspective, since you've mostly been in an agency environment, although you're also tapped into a lot of, I think, great conversations through the events you attend.
Yeah, I think, and so in the consultancy world, I think it's still a little bit hierarchical. And when things are hierarchical, in my view, they cannot necessarily, well, not they cannot, that it's very difficult to be very inclusive when it all hinges on a kind of pyramid-like hierarchy. And it, having been a part of that pyramid hierarchy, actually head of department, I, in the last working place, I really try to kind of look at alternative models of structuring leadership, for instance. So there is a holocratic model when you don't take the top cut. So you know how leadership teams are usually formed, as like the most senior people in the room, who very often happen to be an all-inclusive bunch that have worked together in the past or went to the same places and so on. Instead of that, if you take a vertical cut of the organization from different levels, from different kind of ability, different backgrounds and so on. So if you include people that are starting their design career or that are kind of midst their design career into the leadership team, that opens up a completely different set of opportunities in what I've seen. And I've just started implementing that before kind of closing with my last place. And that model has been used. If you look historically, like if you look at different countries and different councils of like, you know, 7, 14, you name it, people from like different backgrounds and walks of life and how they would prototype different laws and so on. So that's not unheard of. This is just...
Is that the holocratic model that you've spoken about?
Yes, that is the holocratic model of governance. And I feel like more teams will have that, but for real, not just fake of like, okay, you're ambassador for culture. Oh, you're ambassador for this, but your actual job title or role is still like a midway designer. And we're going to treat you as according to that hierarchy because we're selling you as a resource. Now, that's a very different approach as opposed to genuinely trying to invert that hierarchy with introducing a blended leadership team model. That then enables a couple of things to happen. And one of those things is definitely people talking about the real issues on the ground firsthand, rather than leaders collecting some sort of secondhand knowledge, then trying to action it, trying to implement it, having a very big loop between like when the things actually happen to when they can react to them, because leaders are busy, because they are solo apart and the top of that pyramid very often. It's, to me, we have to do much more structural work within design teams in order to see a real diversity. Now, that's one. The second and very often uncomfortable topic is that diversity and inclusion can only happen when it's actively prioritized. And prioritizing one thing means actively almost deprioritizing other things. So not many organizations are willing to really invest time. Like, it's easy to take the top of the pile portfolio, and that top of the pile is very likely, and top of the pile candidates, portfolios, very likely to be people who had the best opportunities in life. And they had those best opportunities because they didn't have maternity career breaks. They didn't have, they went kind of a straight line to the beautiful, you know, capable, amazing design person that surely they are. But There will not be too much diversity if we choose from that pool. So essentially what I've implemented across the past organizations was that active prioritization of diversity and inclusion. And it takes time, and hiring takes twice as much time because you're searching for those candidates and you are looking really far and wide. But when it does happen and it's possible, and you commit to it, it's amazing results. Because the results from a multicultural design team are very different from the results from the people from like the same area. And not purely due to the richness of the experiences and diversity on every level that they have. So yeah.
I know that hiring for diversity is something that a lot of agencies and organizations in general want to aspire to. So it sounds like the framework you've come up with is a much more proactive one, going after particular types of candidates versus just saying, oh, we have an inclusive policy for incoming applicants.
Yeah.
And that sounds like a great approach to having a more intentional hiring structure.
Yeah. It's very difficult, to be honest, and it does need a certain prioritization from like all the other departments within the company as well. So it needs to be constantly, diversity and inclusion definitely is something that needs to be constantly driven, constantly promoted, constantly kind of for people to become a part of that discussion, not just kind of driven from one department or like having a
embedded in the culture rather than
embedded in
some top-down mandate. Yeah. So you've talked a little bit about leadership and leadership models so far. I wanted to pivot a little bit because I know that mentoring is very important to you, and you've spoken previously about design leadership as an ever-evolving service. Mm-hmm. So I'd love for you to share with our listeners what that ever-evolving service looks like and how mentorship has played a role in your career.
Yeah, I think mentorship is an interesting one. I mentored people for like a very, very, very long time. But as many, you know, like if we go back to philosophy for a second. So I bet you can name at least 10 male philosophers and you will not be able to name one female, or maybe two, maybe three. Am I right?
Yes, and I took philosophy classes.
Yeah, there you go. So like, but you know, if you start reading about female philosophers, one thing stands out is that they never considered themselves philosophers. Very few of them actually, you know, had that label. A lot of them were active in that space, but they didn't consider themselves as like this invisible work. So I have been doing mentorship for a long, long, long time as an invisible work. And I still feel very sensitive about like mentioning it because I feel like it's a two-way relationship. It's meaningful. It matters. But I feel somehow that it's a part of what everyone should be doing rather than a part you should be shouting about.
Yeah.
I love sharing time resources. I went through a difficult journey myself in terms of the career. I'm privileged. I'm still very privileged. My parents were able to finance my studies, so I didn't have to work at the same time. And I had to start working straight after. But, you know, that is privilege. And I feel like UK entry to the UK market was difficult because I didn't have experience, but at the same time. So I went through this. I understand how difficult it is. And I'm helping people with portfolios, with transitions, with telling their story and so on. But I feel that's almost kind of a given that everybody should do. In terms of leadership as a service, I just certainly don't believe in leadership as something cultivated in the like. So, you know, I've spoken about the pyramid today. So like the top of the pyramid and like this idea of like, we should be doing that and we should be leading people. I read something today that resonated a lot and is that leadership should be, I'm using the word should, but I'm very hesitant about it. It's kind of leadership in my view is very much about understanding and adapting to the needs of the team, but also helping people, yourself included, imagine different future, the future different from what it is now, in themselves as practitioners. So there is always this, and through the agencies that I've been in, there was always this delineation in my head as a leader. My duties are to the company, of course, to help growth, profit, everything else, but to individuals, to help them grow within their career path. And as a practitioner, as a leader, as their teammate, I'm learning in the process. So there is not kind of, in my view, leadership as a service in the simplest terms is designing with people, understanding how they work, how the behaviors, how the structures of the company impact their daily lives, and then helping either adapt the structures or change the structures or take the difficult conversations. Thank you, Eastern European heritage. I'm very good with like just telling things.
Bluntness, yes.
Sometimes, you know, and sometimes I have been called in those boardrooms in every sense, you know, aggressive, challenging, and so on. And that was part of my learning. And part of the way of understanding how, you know, how you sell design, how you work within the constraints and so on. So in essence, the essence of leadership for me is helping people see a different tomorrow and see themselves differently very often and kind of perhaps detached from like day-to-day tasks where designers tend to get very ingrained into what they're currently doing. So to give you a very specific example, for the new year last year, we've done this analysis of like all of our clients, all of our work, but we've put that in context of the world and like what that actually means. So we help a certain retailer to deliver groceries, meaning that this amount to build systems and products to deliver that, right? So therefore, we have helped this amount of families to kind of to have a good Christmas and so on. So people were like, you don't necessarily think as a designer when you're solving a problem within an interface that this is the impact you're having, but I feel it's always very important to bring that impact in and to show that with every action potentially that we're doing as designers, we're either helping or hindering something or changing something that is very, very important for us to know, to then act. So this is where ethics comes into it, right? So will you or will you not work with a certain client? Where is the boundary for you as an individual? I had teams before. I had said no to working with certain clients, and I was lucky at the time. My bosses were very, very open to me not working on that. And same for my teams. I always felt that there are two levels there. There is level one is individual. Am I as an individual feeling that I'm contributing my design skills to ultimately a cause that I believe in or can relate to? Second level of that, of the responsibility, is the company. So the company will say yes or no to certain clients based on their values. And those are super important. And I always felt like everywhere I've been in, they were adhered to.
That's such a gift to be able to feel that way about where you work. So it sounds like you see leadership, you see your role as a leader in the past as helping designers go beyond the interface, go beyond the screens to think more big picture so that they can also think aspirationally about the impact they can have in their role, in their career, what they want their career to evolve into. How do you help? Because, you know, so much of what we do at Pragmatic Design is empowering designers to connect their work to the big picture, to think about business models, to think about strategy, to think about how the work they do has this larger impact, or in kind of, as you frame it, to think about systems more holistically. So how do you help encourage that among practitioners that you have led?
The first and probably not an expected answer would be by playing and taking people outside of the context of work. So we have done quite a few. I've run moderator trainings around like game and game theory and how we apply it to teaching people to moderate interviews in a better manner, trying to kind of play through different scenarios. There are a couple of games there. We've done a typography quest at the museum, enabling. This is the nerd part, right? So we have transformed the museum into the escape room, and we designed things around it where the teams were working with each other against time to kind of solve certain things. And they learned about typography, also learned about the history, also learned about kind of choices of fonts and so on. So for me, bottom line, quite a bit of these things, even within the UX industry, it's very interesting to see quite a few things are framed in a relatively boring way, let's face it. And like when you start doing it or start doing the mundane tasks, it's very difficult to see whether you're getting better at them. Yeah. I mean, you see like you're repeating things. But if you ask moderators, I've recently conducted a study on inclusive research and I've spoken to moderators. And if you ask moderator or anyone who moderates the qualitative research, which is asking people questions around the product and so on, if you ask them, simple question of how do you know you're getting better as a moderator? The answer is very often, we don't know, unless the client has some feedback on the session, which, you know, because you don't connect to the participant after the session. So yeah. In a way, the only way for you to get real feedback is to seek that feedback proactively, which you, due to time constraints or even like having a not so easy way of receiving it, you know, yourself or processing negative feedback takes a lot of skill and experience to start really seeking out for a lot of negative feedback in order to work on your own practice. Yeah. So that's, to me, a lot of these things, they can be solved with trying to take people out of the work context and into kind of a bit of a play environment where then the learnings can be applied back to kind of mundane tasks. And I've done that quite a bit with the teams and kind of went outside beyond. It's almost that diversity example. I can think of another example of it. So I joined the team remotely, my previous team. I literally just saw them on the screen, 20 people. At that point, there were 14, I think, on the screen. And there was COVID, like tier 4, tier 3, we couldn't meet. And we said, we ran like vision sessions, ensured that, you know, we have a clear vision towards which we're going to. Then we said, but how do we keep connected? Like if we're not allowed to meet. So like we obviously placed each other on the map. So we all knew where the team was located, where people kind of live around London. Hello, GDPR, but friendship group as well. So that's fine. You know, we all knew where we are. So we went for walks in like twos when it was allowed to. But then when it was a complete lockdown, we spent about an hour and a half in our team meetings just roaming the city. And I said, okay, let's just talk about what we see. Let's talk about what we connect. And, you know, we connected, we talked about, again, culture, childhood, where we're all from, and we're all in different areas. We're having those one walk a day that was allowed to us in different areas. London. And that certainly kept us together. We started looking forward to the Fridays when there's this at that point already 16, 20 people in headphones kind of going and talking about different things mm-hmm. with a lot of people on the call. But that was a necessary escape from reality that brought us closer and created that strong bond within the team. So that's kind of one example I can think of. It's quite specific. It's like, if you were a part of a traditional hierarchical organization, you would just be like, no, we have one catch up when we sit in front of our screens and we talk about the work that we've done, you know, through the week, and we share. And like, we've done that later when we were already meeting in person and the connection was established. But in the beginning, we were just like, let's choose a theme. Let's talk about a few things and let's just walk.
Yeah,
that's different from
it reminds me, we had another guest talk about how sometimes the best ideas can come to you when you're gardening or taking a shower. Just I think about how, you know, in order to be creative, in order to think aspirationally, like you're saying, sometimes it requires removing yourself from that, the day-to-day grind, the context of your work, and giving some space, some creative space.
Absolutely.
And I think that kind of leads me to the next question. How do you, it sounds like you've already touched on this, but how do you think design leaders can better support that bonding, that culture building and employee well-being on their design teams?
First point is probably by leading with the team rather than, you know, behind in front, all these metaphors mm-hmm. of like that presume hierarchy. It's so weird for me. It's like being a part of the group, leading within the group, distributing decision making, understanding how, you know, there are people who naturally take on leadership, parts of the leadership. So enabling for that to happen, creating that safe space for people to act and share. In my view, it's very, very important. But all of this can only happen if you truly understand what the team makeup is. So like, before I joined my previous place, I mapped them. Like I mapped so much. I was like, these are the 14 people. These are friends with these people. And these are a bit burned out. And these are a bit sad because this happened. You know, like almost like a psychological mapping plus the what happened, like almost history of like people's connections and what brought them together. And then it's almost like a meta design material, right? You're looking at this as a design project. You would be doing that for the client, going, I'm going to map your services. So here we're mapping people and how they connect. And therefore you're like, okay, so with that group, what we can try is these set of actions. With another group, we can try this. So and you try and establish, like in a design project, issues to solve, the most immediate issues, the ones that are kind of long-standing, and then experiment with different approaches to it. So I've experimented for sure, like we've implemented no overtime policy in our team, for instance, where 37.5 is an absolute, like a golden number over which mm-hmm. you would go. And you would then flag it and get it back as a holiday. We've done things like that. We've done a lot of different things to support work-life balance and any other activities within the team kind of are in the same way. So I just look at it as design material and then try and figure out what are the experiments that we can run to solve some of the, say, behavior issues or a relationship. And another important point, I think a lot of, you know, how I've gone through a lot of mergers as well, and a lot of mergers mm-hmm. start the same thing. It's like, nothing is going to change. This is the biggest lie. The absolutely biggest lie of them all, because coming back to philosophy, Buddhists, right? Everything changes all the time. And that's the first principle of Buddhism.
Only constant.
Right? Change is the only constant. So therefore, admitting change should be a first step to like, cool, change happens. Okay, it's about to happen or it is happening. Now, how do we address these things? Or like, there are two organizations, or two teams or two units. Let's map the gaps. Let's understand like how different they are. What are the differences? So we went through this exercise coming back to diversity and inclusion. I'm jumping a bit, but we went through this exercise with a team where we said, let's come to our definition of inclusion through exclusion. Now, let's talk about the areas or instances where we felt excluded. And it was a very personal session. Like, I've asked permission because, like, there is a lot, like, exclusion is a tender and a difficult ground and needs to be tread carefully, because people feel very, very strongly. They remember, they have very vivid memories of how they were excluded, be it, you know, them being in a certain circumstance or a part of the same group or and so on. So we went through that and we had like an hour and a half of talking about that. And then we flipped it and we said, well, how might we design an organization where these things just wouldn't happen? So it was so useful because it's even understanding. First of all, again, we got to know each other better. And I would have never, it was quite painful in the sense that hearing people being excluded in general is just infuriating to me. It's one of my personal values. I just can't handle injustice, as in I want to fix it. Mm. I want to fix it as soon as I can humanly.
And what an empathy building exercise too, with a diverse team, to be able to share candidly.
Yes. And it was a great one, to be honest. And I highly recommend the teams. You were asking about leadership and how leaders could help their teams. Perhaps I could recommend running that exercise within the team for the leaders to understand what is that most painful memory that their team members hold on to from the past that made them feel excluded, that triggered them in, because you treasure those memories. And then they do trigger all sorts of things in the future. And how might you as a leader try and avoid those situations for them? That was so useful. Like, I got to know so much and I adjusted my own behaviors also on the basis of that, because I would have never thought that me saying something would like trigger someone's memory from like 10 years ago. But in fact, being that it was the case. And yeah, I think it's very important to try and work through that with a team.
And that's just such a great approach. Oh, let's figure out what inclusion is by first talking about what inclusion is. It reminds me a little bit of this exercise I've taken part in before, the bad idea contest. Like, what's the worst possible idea? Yeah, I think it's a popular exercise. What's the worst possible idea for addressing this problem? Okay, what would kind of the opposite of that idea be? And maybe that's how we arrive on good solutions. I love the way you talk about leadership and mentorship and building team cultures as a design project. I think that so much what we talk about at Pragmatic, what our guests talk about who come on Design Chats, is a lot of these tools are at our disposal already. The tools to create better solutions can be used towards building better cultures, applying our design superpowers towards the internal organization, to building relationships. I think it's just a lovely concept to treat leadership as well as a design project, because it forces you to bring this intentionality into the way that you're leading teams, the way that you're helping talent to flourish. If you can put yourself back in the shoes, we always like to kind of close out with what your guidance is or your advice is for practitioners, things they can start to do differently, or maybe practitioners who want to pursue inclusive design. What is your advice for people who are earlier in their careers who want to pursue inclusive design or, you know, inclusive research? What could they start doing now to set themselves up for that?
I would say a very personal advice would be make a list of your own biases and try and consciously track when this happens and revert, or try and use like a substitution going, you know, hang on a minute, I think I was biased right now, let me start again. Like, consciously track your own, like try to honestly go through the list. There is this huge list of biases possible. Like, I won't trouble you with it. Like, it's very, very long, but
yeah.
If a practitioner could consciously kind of figure out, these are the five things that I keep doing that I would love to kind of stop doing and be more inclusive. So that's one relatively simple. You go, okay, I need to reflect on my own practice and understand what am I doing. Another point is definitely the communication. So as designers, we communicate all the time. And we write decks and we write proposals and we deliver things and we talk to people. Thinking about how other people perceive our work makes a big difference. For me, at some point we were talking with RNIB, Royal National Institute of the Blind, and the change that they suggested at some point, there was a conversation and they said, so any slide that you put on, like a diagram, you need to explain it to us in words. And I was like, you know, like with design, in the conference, like there are often, very, very often, there are a lot of like slides, a lot of diagrams. Can you imagine what would have happened if you had to just talk through what you have presented on that slide? Now, that changed a lot of things for me. So like that conversation in my practice, I was like, hang on a minute. So how might I make my slides, make my communication accessible to more people than it currently is? Like, and one thing is obviously like artistic effect when you're, you know, showing a slide and you want some impact, but actually think about it. How do people with vision impairment view it? What about hearing impairment? What about, and like trying to apply those lenses. So there are a lot of good toolkits. There are a lot of good accessibility features for when you create the presentations, which I can share after as a list of resources as well. To just think about, like, if you were to want for your communication to kind of reach people further, what changes would you do to it? Would you still use that complex diagram, or maybe you would try and explain it in a simpler way? So that's the second change, is definitely thinking about how accessible your communication is to others. I think it's just seek diversity in your surrounding, in projects, in kind of learning about it. We joke now that as part of our company, suddenly, and now the clients that start talking to us, they're within sustainability space, they're within ethics space, they're within kind of save the world space. And we're like, how did that happen? It's like magic. Like, I've never, you know, somehow it's like you do get, because people do, once you start working within that field, you start attracting wonderful people. Like, I've met wonderful in HMRC, they are doing so much work on inclusive services, on like inclusive recruitment, on testing, on, and you start expanding your field by people equally passionate about making things, reducing the barriers to entry. So that everyone can have the best experience that they can possibly. And that's my third piece of advice, is probably seek diversity, expand your network by people who are equally passionate in that search.
And I'm a firm believer that good people lead to other good people. So that I love that advice. So I'd love to just ask where our listeners can follow your work, because you speak so much and you publish a lot. Where can they find more of your work?
Probably the best one would be LinkedIn. So just my LinkedIn. And we do now run a page for Cosmic, which I also run out of three of us partners. So within Cosmic Velocity, there is LinkedIn for Cosmic and LinkedIn for me. It's the best place, to be honest. That's the only place I have time in. But we do a lot of work in terms of like training for organizations within inclusion and diversity space. So we're also very happy to just come and talk about this. We're developing our game. A lot of people are asking, when could they get our game? And it's a card game. It's a physical card-based game on diversity and inclusion and making sure that your research is inclusive. And we keep saying, like, just let us breathe. We need to
launch the agency first. Publish the game after.
Exactly. That's the plan. That's absolutely the plan. So LinkedIn is the best platform. And then obviously we're all there. All three of us are there.
Wonderful. Well, Alex, it has been so great to talk with you. I really appreciate you taking the time to share your story and your perspective on Design Chats. And for other people who are out there listening, looking to contribute more strategically, drive value in their organizations, and build their influence, explore our training offerings at pragmaticinstitute.com/design. Thank you, Alex.
Awesome. Thank you, Erin. Pleasure.